If you'd like taxes to be paid by the rich, you may have liked life in the British monarchy. Well, at least at the time of a certain Stuart King. He lost his head trying to tax the rich. Charles I, grandson of Mary, Queen of Scots, took over the British throne from his father, of King James Bible fame, in 1625. His reign was troubled, though. Religious battles, wars, distrust of his constituents, and, most pressing, a lack of money. War with Spain and the Scottish rebels had drained the treasury, and he was forced to seek the help of that legislative body of England, the Parliament, in raising taxes. With Parliament's meeting, and with its money, came its grievances and demands to the king. The Parliament at this time was populated with new merchants and industrialists of this age, increasingly religious reformers such as Quakers and Puritans, who were skeptical of Charles's religion and his commitment to Protestantism. Charles, for his part, did everything he could to work around Parliament and get money directly as king. He invoked some medieval rules to tax shipping centers for their protection, and to make anyone with land that rented more than 40 pounds a year a potential knight, which really meant he'd get a fee from them. He voided noble and church land titles, then gave them back, charging rent now for the privilege of having them. And he went after wealthy men for forced loans and arrested them if they would not pay, sued knights and viscounts in his court to raise money for the country, all by taxing the rich. Oh, but Charles was no Robin Hood. He took the estates of orphans with wealthy parents so he could have the money. He adjusted the borders of his forests so he could charge landowners rent for now using his newly defined fields. And he sold monopolies to certain men. And these men were exclusively licensed to enter the business markets in England. This was not pleasing to the merchant class and the unfavored nobles. And soon, after a series of disputes and attempts to get taxes, there could be no reconciliation, and a parliamentary army was formed to oppose the king. The king formed his own army. Parliament held London, the king held Oxford. And after two wars, lasting over 6 years, with the help of the Scots, the Parliament beat the king. Charles was beheaded, and his taxing power, the monarchy, gone for a bit. Yet the replacement, the short-lived Republic and Protectorate of Oliver Cromwell, also needed money. For in addition to paying its own army, it engaged in wars with the Spanish, the Dutch, the Irish, and eventually the Scots, their old allies. The Protectorate enacted excise taxes on goods sold, greatly raising the price of meat and grain on average citizens. In 1647, in the town of Smithfield, a man refused to pay the tax on his livestock. He was arrested by the excise officers. The next day, a mob drove the excise officers away. A full rebellion started and would only stop after the tax on meat had been dropped. Now you know your history, and you'll probably know that at the same time, across the ocean, there were English colonial governments in what is now the United States. And in Virginia, they also needed to fund their operations. The colony introduced a tax on every free white male, 1 pound of tobacco, in order to pay the expenses for the governor and the House of Burgesses. It was 1 pound, whether a person was wealthy or not. This was not a progressive tax. It was an early poll tax, a form of taxation which would exist in colonial times and go through to the 1960s, particularly in the South. The governor eventually got smart, though, and he started getting his salary out of a tariff, a cut of the tobacco on every hogshead that was sent to England. Easier to get it from the boats than from the people. It was a southern phenomenon, this poll tax, and for the most part, northern states and the new western states tended to use a tax on property, particularly real estate. Boston was funded through the property tax system since the 1600s. Personal property could also be taxed, everything from boats to horses to livestock. This could be taxed, and these could be considered taxes on the lower middle class and poor. On the My History Can Beat Up Your Politics.com Facebook site, Carl Fulbright writes, if you type tax the into Google, just tax the, you get tax the rich, tax the poor, and tax the wolf. I understand taxing the rich, and assuming that taxing the wolf is mutually incomparable. What is the history of taxing the poor? Where did this concept, taxing the poor, come from? Well, Carl, thank you, and I did attempt this on Google, by the way. I didn't exactly get the same result, but Google changes its algorithms and different things will come up at different times. Tax the Wolf, by the way, is the name of a band, and they're actually fairly good. I did listen to a few of their songs. But the simple answer to your question is, this concept of the tax poor is certainly modern times. Common pattern throughout history is governments going out of their way to avoid taxing its poorest citizens, particularly where they're voters. Colonial governments used paper money and notes to avoid taxation where possible. They would just print more money in order to defray expenses. Merchants would not take the money of the colonial governments. This continued when colonial governments became state governments. And so when it came time to fund a revolution, taxing the poor was not the immediate consideration. Something that doesn't get talked about a lot and seems so trivial, of course, but this whole overthrow the king thing was expensive. Scores of millions of dollars in muskets, gunpowder, uniforms, food, soldiers' pay, officer pay, cannons, and the like. I know. Why quibble about the price? The country's worth so much more now, and it's a great country. But something like $70 million in debt was left over years after the fighting. The Continental Congress relied on rich men, Robert Morris, and the sale of bonds in order to finance things. The state of Virginia, for instance, had a currency that was worthless by the time of the Revolutionary War, and several rich men, including Carter Braxton, signer of the Declaration of Independence, and others, had to put their own fortunes on the line to back up the state of Virginia. But especially helpful was the rich men of Amsterdam, who provided loans of 5 million guilders and then 9 million guilders to help us defray costs and to stick a finger in the eye of their maritime enemy, England. So we had all this debt, and the new American government, once established with a constitution, needed money. The Constitution gave the federal government one of the more popular taxes, the tariff. It was a good tax in the way, and one of the reasons the constitutional framers wanted it, because it was a tax that the average citizen didn't feel when it was being paid. Yet, there was a growing expense. Secretary Hamilton, Treasury Secretary, convinced Washington to set up internal excise taxes as well. Whiskey, he said, had grown to a mature industry in the West. So he recommended a tax of 4 cents per gallon. And, he said, assess the distilleries, where it's being produced. It raised money, he said, but if the effect was that some consumption would be lowered, why, that would be desirable too. It was a moral tax. Hamilton set up revenue collecting districts and appointed tax collectors to go out into the west of the country. And at this point, the west, not California, of course, the west would have been western Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Mountains, western Virginia. By now, a lot of people who study American history know the story. The whiskey tax was really hard on some of these grain farmers, especially because whiskey was used as currency for trade. And many of these farmers could not get their grain to markets. The markets in the East were too far away to deliver the grain they were growing, so they had to convert it to whiskey for it to be in any form to sell at all. So not surprisingly, when men like Zachariah Biggs and William McCleary set up the first Western Virginia's revenue districts and tried to collect those taxes, they met resistance. Biggs was met by 50 men and was persuaded not to collect the tax. McCleary was roughed up by a crowd of 30 until he told them that he had resigned, ran away, and swam in a river to escape. The combination of citizen protest meetings in Western Pennsylvania and armed gangs such as the Whiskey Boys and Tom Tinker's Boys roaming Western Virginia and Pennsylvania to stop collectors from doing their job had an effect. Very little money of the internal tax was collected. U.S. Marshals came in and made arrests, and then their prisoners would be freed by mobs. Eventually, President Washington led a militia in, a militia of 13,000, crushed the rebellion, arrested two leaders, which he later pardoned. We know the story. But the part of the story that's not well known is that still, even after the rebellion itself was crushed, very little of these taxes were paid. The federal government still continued to get most of its revenue from excise taxes at the ports. Under John Adams, The Congress passed a federal property tax in order to pay for a navy when we thought we might have to go to war with the French. Ironically, one of the captains of Washington's militia who helped crush the rebellion in Pennsylvania now led his own, John Fries, protested the so-called house tax, and he advocated armed resistance and intimidated agents. He was arrested and also pardoned by the president. Both of these taxes raised little money, but were huge political issues for the Republican Party in America, and did end the Federalist Party. The first sign was the defeat of Tom Fitzsimmons, a Federalist congressman, by John Swanwick in Federalist-controlled Philadelphia. That was a bellwether election in 1794. Swanwick said he didn't support the insurrection in the West, but he was against the whiskey tax. Thomas Jefferson and his Republicans would win Pennsylvania in 1800 and the White House. Once in office, after just about a year, Jefferson repealed both taxes, the property and a whiskey excise tax. The phrase tax the poor would never have been used by a Jeffersonian Republican. It would have been considered cruel even a decade ago. It just didn't exist in our politics and history, and even today is a bit bizarre. But given the cascade of stimulus tax cuts, deductions, rate reductions, credits over these recent years, we're now at the point where 47% of U.S. households pay no income tax to the federal government. And this is an increase, but it's not completely new. In 2003, that number was more like 40%. Still, when 60% of people are paying, it's a little more manageable of a concept than about half of Americans not paying, which is the point you're hearing a lot of now. At the time in 2003, a Wall Street Journal article, now infamous, talked about the lucky duckies who paid no taxes in America. This article drew scorn, I think justified scorn, for its portrayal of the working poor as lucky duckies. Given the increase in the number of non-payers and the growing deficit and the attention on it, the debate's taken on a new life. Calls for reform, flat taxes, and fears of a potential tyranny of the poor have been expressed. Jim DeMint, senator from South Carolina, stated that the fundamental relationship between the taxpayers and the government is that the people will keep a check on government because they're paying part of the burden. But once you take a group of voters and release them from that burden, they'll just keep electing people that will give them more and more tax cuts and increase spending on the others. In the theory of the thing, I think DeMint has a compelling point, at least in theory. Whether it's actually going on, we'll talk about it a little bit. Perhaps if he channeled the ancient Republicans, he wouldn't find it so troubling. There's always been a group of income taxpayers that don't pay. Lincoln's income taxes exempted those making less than $800 a year during the Civil War, and that was the first American income tax. In 1862, he lowered the exemption to $600, but there still was an exemption. The people have accepted the tax with cheerfulness, his tax director said. I doubt that was true. But a well-justified tax, one that's during a war, one with an exemption for those lesser classes, does help to add to the cheer. The tax actually lasted a few years after Appomattox, but it was phased out in the 1870s. The first income tax, constitutionally supported and not during a war, was in 1913. After the constitutional amendment passed, it was those making $3,000 or more had a tax of 1%. Most people convincing their state legislatures to pass it weren't going to pay the tax. There's always been a high degree of progressivity in the income tax system, meaning you're paying more as you make more. And that usually the highest marginal rate is higher than it is today. It was 68% under Truman. It was up to 91% under Eisenhower, 75% Kennedy Johnson, 50% Reagan, 35% today. One can look at those high marginal rates at the 50s and 60s and say they were near confiscation. On the other hand, we've come a long way down with a top rate of 35%, especially where deductions reduce taxes further. Warren Buffett, yes, the bit overquoted rich guy, once challenged his executive friends to say if they were paying a higher rate than their receptionist. Tax the rich, tax the poor, tax the wolf. I don't care how many Palm Beach palaces, 18-room mansions, exclusive golf courses you point to. You can't seem to get around this fact that 47% of the households are not paying any taxes. I mean, there's probably a good percentage of them that shouldn't, but is 47 the right number? Almost half. We can't have that discussion yet until we enlarge the scope here. All Americans, including the poor, pay taxes. Despite that statistic we said earlier, all Americans pay taxes. If nothing else, they pay taxes on alcohol and tobacco use. But they also pay sales taxes. And if they are working poor, who do own a home, they pay property taxes. And if they rent, their landlord pays taxes and prices it into the rent. These are not small contributions. In many states, Texas, Florida, Colorado, sales tax are the highest percentage of revenue. Washington State, for instance, it's 66% of the revenue of the state's coming from sales tax. Whether it's Warren Buffett or Warren the truck driver buying an item at the store, they pay the same 6 cents on the dollar. Now, the percentage varies by state. California is up to 8.25, with an extra 2 points for some cities. But I'll say this about the Golden State. They do exempt food purchases. Not all states do. Alabama, Hawaii, West Virginia, Kansas, Mississippi, South Dakota, and Virginia are among states that include food, though many of these states give you a little discount. Arkansas gives you a 2% discount for food. These states are taxing the way Oliver Cromwell did, taxing meat. But they do this to keep property and income taxes low. These sales taxes, excise tax, could be called regressive because people with little money pay taxes on a greater percentage of their income under these schemes. They have to consume more of their income. They simply have to. Whereas a Warren Buffett has a good deal of his income that is not needed for his personal consumption. Sales taxes are not all bad, and they should always be included in the revenue mix. In fact, they could be considered a good tax for a few reasons. You can help them a bit by adding food exemptions and clothing exemptions. Pennsylvania, New Jersey do this. Massachusetts has a clothing exemption, up to $100 of clothing. So no leather jackets, folks, but for most clothing, you get an exemption. But consumption taxes do have this advantage. If you don't have the money, you don't pay the tax. If you're thrifty, the government rewards that thrift. You know, you pay the tax as you buy something. So, right, it's a bad event occurring at the same time as a good event. When it comes to property tax, they are also funding schools. This is a tax on the home, and it can also be very regressive. You can make them less so by exempting owner-occupied homes. Alabama mostly does this, but most states still charge for owner-occupied homes. During the Depression, many states would waive property taxes on owner-occupied homes. Given the cost increase, it's just not possible for states to do that. Homes pay schools in most states. So, in truth, I think what we've seen here, looking at that side of the equation, that there are no real lucky duckies. Everyone pays the piper on something. Did we jumble this discussion too much by expanding the scope? Let's bring it back to the federal discussion. And this is the way we'll do it. We've said that the poor pay property and sales taxes. These taxes fund what states do. Roads, police, schools, parks, libraries, health departments, state regulators of utility companies. These are services that are actually used by those of a lower income. Could this be a case of you pay for what you get? Poor pay taxes on their Kohler, their cold cut, or their home in order to pay for the teacher that will teach their child, or for the road that they take to work to get paved, hopefully. And if you add in those federal taxes that are also considered regressive, you know, Social Security taxes, for instance, Medicare taxes, the FICA tax, these are payments for which you're going to get something at least in the future. But for the most part, 47% of American homes skip the payment for the stealth bomber and the Coast Guard and for maintenance on the Capitol Dome when the hat is passed. These grand expenses are paid for by the rich. Well, there's historical support for that. You know, Charles I, Lincoln, Woodrow Wilson. These taxing schemes for any grand effort of the federal government was put to the rich. But is it a good system that 47% of households pay no contribution to the government charged with general welfare and a more perfect union? What about Senator DeMint's argument? A non-tax population will just keep raising taxes on the rich population. It's no skin off their back. Well, I think there's a couple things to look at with that argument. One right off the top is, if that's true, if that could happen, Why isn't it occurring in every one of the 50 states in the Union? That argument might overestimate the political organization of the poor. Actually, the poor tends to have lower turnout. It also puts the blame on them for some of these tax deductions and credits, etc., when in many cases it was something the democracy decided for them. I mean, we can blame people for all of the left, right, and compromised middle type stimulus plans you had, the Bush tax cuts, the increased child deductions, the Clinton increase in the earned income tax credits, the Obama FICA tax cuts, cheerfully voted for again by Mitch McConnell and his senators in the deal of December. Can we blame those who took a first-time home buyer's tax credit and now is paying no taxes because of it? Isn't this what we wanted? So absent blame of the people getting it, I think obviously you do have to reduce the number of zero payers. And I think a lot of people would agree with that. And there's a lot of consensus in the middle on this issue, but you're hearing, of course, the extremes of the debate. Here's an interesting point. Everyone should pay something, candidate Michelle Bachmann said, even if it is a dollar. I have to say, I agree with that statement. I'm not going to make a habit of this whole agreeing with Michelle Bachmann thing, but in this case, I do. There is some basic American truth that you, even if it's a micropayment of a quarter, everyone should be contributing something, yes, even towards the federal government. Otherwise, one could question the stake of the non-payers in the democracy. And I think those that are paying the taxes, when you have that percentage of non-payers, are going to ask and put in a claim for a larger say over how the money's spent. At the same time, with moderation, we should look at whether 35% is the be-all and end-all of federal contribution. If the rate issue gets too dicey, do we have to look at the deductions rather than rates? Tax the rich, though, is a common refrain, and it's not surprising to me that some pundits have, I suspect, created here a rhetorical parry. Tax the rich? No, we'll tax the poor. Once you start raising taxes on the rich, they have at least one time in our history, since we instituted the income tax, gone up. So you had these marginal rates of 91%. Ridiculous, even for a high-income earner. I mean, I think that we often forget that it's not easy to obtain this level of money. Yes, there are some lucky people, rich lucky ducks, I guess you'd say, who have networks, who are handed things to them. But it's particularly when you're looking at salary, I mean, it's awfully hard to get millions of dollars out of the private sector without doing something extraordinary. Anyone who's in a sales type position, you know that people don't perform exactly the same. There's some people who do better than others, and they're better compensated by companies. So to really get intense with those marginal rates, I think, is a problem. And we do have a history of doing it, so we've got to watch that. I think one of the counters to that is if you had an increase on both sides, you might be able to accomplish it politically and as a policy matter. I mean, is 35% the be-all and end-all? Another way to look at that is 373,000. Is that the same as making 10 million a year? According to our tax system, it is. It is craven to celebrate taxing the poor. And I suspect that the politicians that play this card too much are going to end up with a backlash. I mean, a poor single person in the U.S. makes $10,000, $800 a month. Family of four makes $22,000. So in this, as in many issues, we need the cooler heads to prevail, right? There's a moderate solution to this. You can try to lessen the amount of people who are not paying taxes without going after the poor in rhetoric. This is an amplified debate in many ways that doesn't really exist. I tend to think that most people don't want to tax the poor. It's just going to be an argument about what the poor is, if the bills weren't being paid by political fundraising. Now, I think this is in all things. You've got two teams, and one's got to advocate one way, and the other's got to advocate the other. We have binary politics, and so it's either tax the poor or tax the rich. It was interesting that you inadvertently found in your Google search, tax the wolf. And again, I mentioned it was the rock band. But I also think it does represent what a lot of Americans would like to do. You want to tax that other thing, the thing that's not part of your experience, right? You want to tax the rich guy, or the rich guys now increasingly want to tax more the poor, really probably the lower middle class, and have them pay a bigger share. Everyone wants to tax each other. I think there'll be no solution if we don't leave that mindset. I want to thank you for listening. The website is myhistorycompetepurepolitics.com. The Facebook site, you can discuss issues. It would be great to see a lot more people there. Particularly, I was reviewing some old questions and answers podcast, and I heard some names, and I haven't heard some of those people recently, so it would be great to see you ask a question again. And if you do like the program, please tell somebody about it. iTunes is a great place. Well, thank you for listening.